I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the east end of Long Island. Well, we have some breaking news on the art and culture front. The Connecticut Trust for Historic Preservation is now gathering information as quickly as it can to launch a Creative Places Trail in Connecticut. This will be a map and an iPhone app of where artists and writers of the 1900s lived and worked in Connecticut. And they want to hear from you if you know about an artist, a writer, where that person worked. You get to play a part in the creation of this trail. So this is just being announced. I've just had a look at the logo, Creative Places, on a map of Connecticut, and it is a beautiful, beautiful logo. So here are some of the things, besides getting into that, that we're going to be talking about on the show. What makes a building important? What makes it worth preserving? Is it the age of that structure? Is it the person who designed it? What is used for? There's been this idea of out with the old and in with the new in some places. And at times that's been this guiding principle for mayors and governors. But now we have preservation organizations. And I think in the old days we used to think of those as pretty sleepy places. But as you can see from the one here in Connecticut, there's a lot of exciting things going on in their offices as they take to the road and see barns and decide to create a barn app and a barn trail for people, help preserve these things. And so these preservation organizations do the kind of work that helps us to have a conversation in our communities. They say to us, well, should we, you know, as let's take Grand Central Station, that magnificent space, should we just let that go and build something new? Or do we look around that space and say, this is amazing. Let's preserve and renew what's here. Let's bring it back to life with fresh energy again. We see that did not happen at Penn Station, and you see what the result is. So we're going to talk about that. Also, the Connecticut Trust for Historic Preservation established that historic barns trail, and ask yourself, why barns? Of all the things that we could preserve, why was that important? The new focus for the organization is going to be mill buildings. Think about the Cheney Mills in Manchester, Connecticut, or in Willimantic, where they made thread. What could there be trails for across Connecticut? So if you look at what preservation groups target for saving, what does that say about who we are? Is there a structure in your town or city that should be saved, and why? Our guest is Helen Higgins, Executive Director of the Connecticut Trust for Historic Preservation. It's a private nonprofit organization. Welcome back.
Thank you, Faith. I love being here.
Me too. I love having you here. And you're always, Helen knows how excited I get about this. And in you come with this new thing, Creative Places, writers and artists who were living and working in Connecticut. Do they have to be dead?
Oh, no, they don't have to be dead, okay. But we prefer them dead, I think. No, I don't know.
Okay.
No.
So this goes from about 1913, you said,
right,
all the way
right.
up to probably the 1970s.
Correct.
You want to know. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the woman who was an artist in a pharmacy that you just learned about.
I think her name was Ann Perry. She was actually a poet.
Yes.
And her mother and she ran a drugstore in Old Saybrook. And her poetry is very much informed by that place.
Yeah, she was wonderful.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so and I want to give your website address as we go through this mm-hmm. hour. We're going to take some calls.
Great.
As we go through this hour, we want to give people a way to contact you if they know mm-hmm. about artists and writers who've been living and working in the state of Connecticut, and it should be on this trail. And I think that's going to do something for tourism, too, because I know in New York City, I love to walk by the houses of famous writers to see where they lived and how they lived. When I've gone to Nice, gone into many artists' homes that are now museums, and thought, oh, my goodness, this is Monet's hand was on this banister. You know, I just can't believe it. So tell me how this idea for Creative Places came around.
Well, it actually emerged from a conversation that the State Historic Preservation was having with us. They were talking about buildings on the National Register, and somebody said, you know, we just had a lot of creative people in this state, and we don't know anything about where they are other than Mark Twain or, you know, something like that. So it just sort of – it kind of grew from that partnership that we have with the State Historic mm-hmm. Preservation Office. And the geniuses on my staff came up with a good idea,
yeah.
and that is that we would create a massive database of artists and literary figures in Connecticut, and then we would pick the ones who really whose work was informed by where they lived, so that their place tells a story about them and their work rather than this is their birthplace.
Helen, doesn't it make you think about why? Why did so many artists, so many creative people choose Connecticut? I mean, let's speculate.
Well, we are really speculating. We have Rachel Carley out of Litchfield doing that speculation for us. She's a wonderful architectural historian, and she's asking these questions of, you know, why is Northwest Connecticut such a magnet for artists and literary figures? I mean, that's where we're going to find the bulk. But then we find, obviously, Fairfield County is a magnet. So it's almost and New Haven, any place where we have academic institutions, we get the Albers coming to Yale, you know, and other immigrants from Germany.
Don't you think that as the person is listening right now, that person is saying affordability? Oh, there were so many artists who left New York and either went out to the east end of Long Island or came to Connecticut because you could get a house and a bunch of land on the cheap.
You could get it on the cheap and you could get a farm. I mean, you know, it's funny because we've done all this Barnes work, but a lot of the sort of artist literary figures in Northwest Connecticut are on farms in Barnes. So it's an interesting kind of combination. But I think that, you know, creative types are—they're not necessarily wealthy, as you've just mentioned. They like to be in an environment that will stimulate their creativity. And interestingly enough, Connecticut has provided that kind of stimulation.
It can also be. I was thinking of Olana, mm-hmm. the church, the landscape painter from the Hudson School. He was quite well off when he built that Persian-style house in the Hudson Valley, and he chose it for the view. So artists can have other reasons if they can afford it. You know, on the east end of Long Island, so many artists there to paint.
Yeah. Well, actually, this takes us back before our period, but Kensett. An artist out of Darien, or the paintings that he did out of Darien are just filled with the marvelous light that's right on the Sound there. So you're right, but we know that also from the Impressionist trail that you know they were the old Lyme group. And
let's switch over as we talk about preservation about your interest in mill buildings.
Yeah.
What is that? When you so much history is in those buildings, first from the workers, I think, and so many immigrants, and so first and second generation family members working in a lot of the mills in Connecticut. What's your interest in saving them?
Well, mills and mill villages can stimulate revitalization of downtowns. Many of them were in downtowns, particularly in Hartford, some in New Haven and Stamford. And to leave them abandoned, of course, just makes for a negative in a community. But I think I don't know if you know the Baltic Mills, you know, in Sprague. And, of course, that was a massive, several massive fires really have destroyed those mills. But the village around them is really a lovely, you know, smaller houses. And, you know, these are good places for people to live. Now, there's another thing about mills that I really need to mention is that they are near transit hubs. And, you know, with our whole transit-oriented development that, you know, we're talking about, you will find that a mill is a great place to redevelop because you've probably had an old rail line going in or something. So, you know, we're doing kind of the first work to layer on with Department of Transportation and other people you know, as we go along.
Collaborating. So I was thinking about Dia Beacon,
yes.
the museum, in a, what did they make? I think, was it a cracker factory? And so they took over this massive light-filled space that is just extraordinary. And they have these installations, modern artists. Mm-hmm. You know, just amazing. So we see how valuable these multiple uses can be. But also, I think there's, as we're more environmentally conscious, people are a little concerned about what happened in that mill. You know, what products were used? Is this dangerous in any way?
Well, that's part of our challenge, that in redevelopment is we have to mitigate those brownfields. And there are levels. In other words, if you're going to use a mill for residential use, your level of mitigation is much higher than if you're going to use it for an artist studio or a commercial center or an incubator or whatever. And I think one of the exciting things about mill redevelopment today is that people are really thinking beyond creating condominiums. I mean, you know, there's a whole nother way of looking at all the buildings and having, you know, maybe cooking schools and having locally sourced food on farms, you know, I mean, little plots in the mill village. Having small manufacturing companies, having artist startups, you know, on and on and on. So it's not a model based on residence, which really was the model of the 90s, I think.
There's a hotel in a mill building in Beacon, New York, in this charming downtown, sitting on the waterfall that attached to the mill building. And it's been made into this hotel, many of the rooms round, which is why they call it roundhouse. A lot of the interior structure left as it was, the old beams, the brick walls. You can hear the gushing waterfall out on the patio of the restaurant attached to this hotel. Wonderful. And you know, I'm sure they had help from historic preservation groups to do this. So just a terrific reuse of space and buildings. So let's think and explore together about what gets preserved and why. Mm-hmm. So you're doing this creative places, you're just announcing. You're doing the research on that right now. You're interested in mill buildings. You just did the Barn Trail. Mm-hmm. That's an app on the iPhone also. What if somebody wanted to preserve historic diners in Connecticut? What would you think?
They do.
As a trail, I mean.
Oh, as a trail. Oh, it'd be wonderful if we could just keep diners on their original location. They tend to be moving around because they are kind of, you know, urban redevelopment sort of throws them off. So in Torrington now, Ski's Diner, are you familiar with Ski's Diner?
No.
It was, you know, it fed, you know, the night shift, you know, in one of the factories around in Torrington. And ultimately, I think when the factory closed, it kind of closed. And then it was going to be a chamber of commerce or, you know, it was going to get reused. And ultimately, the Torrington Preservation Trust has gotten a hold of it and is going to move it onto its property and open it as a diner.
Mm.
How interesting.
What a great idea.
Open it as a diner on their historic site where they have several historic buildings and they have sort of a mock-up of a factory, a small factory. So it's a really interesting reuse. But you could – a diner trail is a fabulous idea. It's really good.
Okay.
I like that.
Okay. Yeah. That's excellent. Yeah. So we're with Helen Higgins, Executive Director of the Connecticut Trust for Historic Preservation. We're getting at some announcements on the art and culture front about the new Creative Places map in Connecticut, the new Barn Trail that we broke news about here on the show, and coming up, why we preserve the things we do. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Faith Middleton. Thank you so much for listening. We are talking about What gets preserved in Connecticut in terms of historic preservation? I mean, how old does something have to be, or how new can something be? We're with Helen Higgins, who's Executive Director of the Connecticut Trust for Historic Preservation, and we invite you to join the conversation with us on a variety of fronts. If you know about, because they're just announcing, Helen was nice enough to bring with her this announcement that they're starting at the Historic Preservation Trust, creative places in Connecticut where arts and letters flourished in 20th century Connecticut. So from around 1913, 15, 1970s, artists and writers whose work somehow reflects a sense of place when they lived and worked in Connecticut. So we'd love to know if you know of someone. Also, is there a building, a structure of some kind, no matter what its age, that you think deserves to be preserved in Connecticut? I was just floating the idea of an historic diner trail in Connecticut and how fun that would be. Helen, who decides in the end that a category is worth preserving? Is it about age?
Well, actually, there are standards. There are federal standards for architectural significance is as important these days as age. So the Phoenix Building, for instance, which is not 50 years old in Hartford, is on the National Register of Historic Places. And a lot of our modernist houses, like in New Canaan, are on the National Register, even though they're only 40 or 35 years old. So architectural significance is important, but historic significance, of course, the 50-year sort of is the standard rule for a building to be considered worthy of listing on the National Register of Historic Places.
I don't know if you remember in Hamden what I called the ghost parking lot at the mall, where they had an artist had taken the tar of the parking lot and covered cars, old cars that were there, and it was part of the art piece, and that was destroyed. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, I know
that had
that
happened. Yeah. I thought, no, this can't be happening, that somebody's going to destroy this work of art. So if something, let's say a mall from the 60s is sitting there and reflects 60s design, 60s, that 60s urban vibe, would that qualify, could that qualify as important?
Oh, I think it could, absolutely, because it is of an era. It is of a style. I'm not sure. The 60s, no, it was later, the Stanford Mall, which to me, I'm so sorry to those of you in Stanford, but it is the most, you know, people-unfriendly place that I've ever seen. I mean, you know, walking around the street. But it's a statement of an era. We don't have to have beauty to have preservation. You know, it can be just about what is the story that it tells, what does the building tell. I think, you know, looking at more modern, not modern architecture, but recent architecture, and people are always asking, well, do you think McDonald's or, you know, Wendy's and all of these? Well, yeah, I mean, at some point, you know, one or two, you know, might be considered important, but more, I think, with this, because of what happened there or what, you know, what else is important about the place.
I remember as a child in Hartford, there was a hamburger place called White Castle, and everybody went there. And at late night after events, music events, jazz concerts, you'd find people in there. And I think, what a shame that the old White Castle isn't preserved. And I suppose you could make the case for, remember when, was it Kentucky Fried Chicken that originally started in that sort of A-frame shape?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Is one of those architecturally significant and so should be preserved. I love your field because it gets us to ask questions about what's important to us and why. I love the idea that you say it's not just the beauty in a classical sense, but the story of the structure. Mm-hmm. Paul Faith Middleton with Helen Higgins. Welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. Hi. Thanks for having me. I'm involved with the Art League of New Britain, which is housed in an old carriage house, 1870, and right in on Cedar Street in New Britain. And we're looking to keep it going. We're wondering how you guys or this trust might be able to help us through grants or some kind of funding to, you know, keep the place up. Have you ever been there?
No, but we love New Britain.
Oh,
and
good.
we've been working in New Britain quite a bit recently. And Paul, we have a staff member, Brad Scheid, who we call him a circuit rider. He sort of wanders the state, who could be very helpful to you. And we have grants for you.
Oh, great!
So, if you go online to the Connecticut Trust for Historic Preservation.
Right.
You will see all the contact information you need.
Excellent.
Okay. And that is cttrust.org.
Okay.
Okay. Good luck to you.
Thanks a bunch.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was a good first call. Somebody's excited. I know I am. So, how about this? I'm out on the east end of Long Island and I'm wandering down a road on foot and thinking, this is so beautiful. I'm on Shelter Island. And I come upon a completely overgrown miniature golf course with figurines, sculptures on the holes of this miniature golf course from 50s, maybe right. 1950s, 1960s. And I'm snapping pictures of it like crazy. I mean, just fabulous. And I think, seriously? Somebody preserving this? I mean, somebody should be cutting this grass or getting these weeds out of here. This is extraordinary. Can something like that qualify for historic preservation?
Well, yes, of course. I mean, I'm assuming there's some structures on it.
Yeah, well, you know, the way miniature golf courses are, those little crazy structures.
Yeah.
But so beautiful artistically, you know, and I mean that in terms of eccentricity, skill,
right?
You know, just amazing. A big concrete mermaid with a sweeping tail.
Oh, my goodness.
Blonde locks and,
yeah.
You know.
Well, we should get a hold of the Long Island Antiquities group to see what they have to say about it. But absolutely, those kinds of places are very valuable now. We lost in eastern Connecticut, I think it's called Johnsonville in Mudus. That was a...
No.
Yeah.
You did not.
We didn't, but I mean, one did.
Really?
Yeah. I think it was called Johnsonville, wasn't
yes,
it? Yeah.
Yes, yes.
They couldn't get a developer for it, and the state took it down.
That's amazing. That's absolutely amazing. So historic preservation from any angle, 203-776-9677. What does it say about us, what we choose to? Helen, I'm asking you about golf courses now, miniature golf courses,
right.
To see how far outside the box. Mm-hmm. When you send your quote-unquote circuit riders out, mm-hmm. they get trained to know what's worth saving and why. And you know, would they come upon something like that? I mean, how expansive can you be in your thinking is what we're all wondering. Eleanor Faith Middleton with Helen Higgins. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling from Old Lyme, and your topic caught my attention. And that's because I've moved here, and I've become enamored with the whole aura of Roger Torrey Peterson. And I'm hoping you're familiar with him.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Okay.
So Roger Torrey Peterson, in case you're new to the area or not a bird lover, was one of the great bird experts and artists of our time. Just extraordinary. So go ahead.
Well, as you say, it's in the 1900s. He wrote a lot. He painted a lot. And he lived in Old Lyme. And his work reflects where he lived, the Connecticut River estuary and the Connecticut River. And it just so happens that right now his house is for sale.
Oh.
And I just went up to take a peek at it, and it's an eccentric house. And it's not for everybody, but in terms of preserving it, I was wishing that someone would preserve it, maybe the Connecticut Trust for Historic Preservation, because he is such a noted figure for his contributions to conservation and artistry and natural history and conservation biology. I could go on and on.
Yeah.
He became very, very famous and wrote the entire Roger Torrey Peterson Field Guide to North American Birds, Birds of Eastern North America, Western North America, mm-hmm. went on and on, Britain.
It's my go-to guide.
Oh,
well worn and sitting on my shelf every time I go on walking on the nature trail. So I'm so glad you called and let us know about the house. And by the way, Eleanor, you heard Helen talking about these structures aren't always so easy on the eyes. You know, it's
yes.
It's a kind of, you know, the Europeans have a housing model that's interesting where they will, you'll look at the outside of a building and think it's not traditionally beautiful in any way. And you think, what is this? Is this a factory space? What is it? Then you walk in the door and it's a magnificent space unfolds because they don't care so much about that outside approach. They mm-hmm. they believe in a kind of reuse. I'm looking right now in the most recent issue of Connecticut Preservation News, and there's a house here. It's a possible tear down in Darien. This is a house designed by Edward Durrell Stone, who was the good friend of Frank Lloyd Wright, and it is for sale. He was inspired by Japanese architecture, Stone was. It has a wooden interior, shoji screens, harmony with the landscape, and I'm looking at a picture of it right now. So in a style that isn't to everyone's taste, but for those who love something like this, imagine tearing something like that down. So thank you so much for calling and telling us about Roger Torrey Peterson's house. And also a great selection.
Oh, it's great to know about.
For your creative places, Matt.
Yeah, absolutely. We will have to go and see it.
Okay. Paul Faith Middleton with Helen Higgins, Connecticut Preservation Trust. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm calling to let you know that the Polish National Home in Hartford, Connecticut.
Okay, Helen, you know.
Oh, I love it, and we had a board meeting there. It's one of my favorite places in Hartford.
Well, wonderful to hear that. This coming Sunday, December 8th, they're going to be celebrating their 30th anniversary since the building was put on their National Historic Registry.
Oh, my goodness. I was going to say, it's more than 30 years old. It's an Art Deco building. So,
yes, yeah. An Art Deco building, yeah.
Oh, wow. Well, so you're having a lot of kielbasa and everything?
All the different Polish foods and dishes you could think of. Mm.
Pierogi, I can't wait. Ooh. Thank you very much.
So if you could let everybody know, December 8th, they're celebrating 30 years of being on the National Historic Registry.
Thank you. You just did that, my friend.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. So I'm looking at this amazing building. This is the Thomas Lyman House in Durham, Connecticut, around 1790. And so your organization is trying to protect this house. Tell me about what's happening.
Well, it was a gift to the Connecticut Trust from Lillian Studebaker Hardy last summer. And we have, you know, worked on it, put in new septic, and we're selling it. It is a magnificent Georgian center hall house with original paneling in practically every room. I mean, it's just to die for.
Even the locks on the doors, I'm looking at the pictures, are so gorgeous. It's ridiculous.
It's a gorgeous house. It takes a special buyer to come and live in a, quote, antique house. But this has an open floor plan. It's just beautifully suited for all kinds of people. And 13 acres, and I went on a bird walk there a few weeks ago, and there are a lot of birds up there.
You know, we see this on the Litchfield Green. There are people of – it does take some means to be able to keep up a house like this, and there are people who have been able to do that and preserve those stately houses on the Litchfield Green, and I think this is what you're suggesting. I think there are ponds.
Ponds on the property. There was a tennis court. It's a little rough looking, but, hey, you could scrape it off. Lucy Liu, I think is her name, from Madison, has offered pro bono to draw up a landscape plan. And the fellow from Connecticut Audubon, or Audubon Connecticut, who led the bird tour, is going to tell you what are the best plantings to attract birds.
That's great. So we have Helen Higgins of the Connecticut Trust for Historic Preservation. Corey, Faith Middleton, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Faith, for having me on. I believe I worked with Helen briefly on the Mark Greer Scout Reservation, and I still owe you documentation. Mark Greer Scout Reservation in Basra was scheduled for closure, and fortunately we were able to save it for the time being. And I just want to thank you and your organization for being so helpful.
Now, what is this structure that you saved?
It's Mark Greer Scout Reservation in Basra, Connecticut.
A scout reservation. So are there structures on it?
Yes, there's some structures on it, some older buildings that that date back to the early 1900s.
And what is this going to be used for?
It's still going to be used for
scouting
across the board. They had a summer camp program there over the last 30 years, and they decided to suspend that here in Connecticut to consolidate efforts to another camp over by UConn and Storrs. But we're going to keep it open for usage for other scout organizations throughout the state for weekend camping and that sort of thing.
Great. Thank you so much.
So I just want to say thanks, and I love what you guys do.
That Faith, that's another kind of model. Summer camps, children's camps. There's some great old ones around Connecticut that are challenged. But, way up in Northwest Connecticut, the School for the Deaf has a beautiful camp that's on the National Register now. So it's another type of building or whatever. And I also want to go back to you. You said, stretch your mind. Well, we have a skating rink, a roller skating rink up in Suffield that's on the National Register too.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Is it still functioning or?
I think so. I'm not really sure. Yeah.
How beautiful. Yeah. All right. We're going to take a quick break and then more on historic preservation in Connecticut and this announcement that a trust is starting Creative Places Where Arts and Letters Flourish in the 20th Century in Connecticut. We'll tell you about that as soon as we come back. Stay with us. I'm Faith Middleton, and you can tweet us at FaithWNPR. That's FaithWNPR. Join the conversation with us on Facebook. Search The Faith Middleton Show. We thank you for listening, and thanks to our talented team, senior producer Lori Mack and producer Jonathan McNichol. And right now, you can see delicious recipes for dinner, value wines, easy cocktails, and more. You can check right now at our website. Just click on programs at WNPR.org for The Faith Middleton Show, or click anytime you want for tons and tons of recipes and wine and cocktail ideas. Helen Higgins is here, Executive Director of the Connecticut Trust for Historic Preservation. We just heard Terry Gross recently talking about an interview that she's going to be doing with someone who's written about the baseball great Ted Williams, that his head is cryonically frozen. I guess that is appropriate. This is a form of preservation. Helen Higgins, tell me about, we've got Jeff. Jeff, they're asking for the phone number, 203-776-9677. Go ahead, Jeff.
Okay, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to make one comment that, for me at least, historical preservation is really something that I think about in the not-so-far past. I like to think about and reminisce the stores I used to shop at, the shopping centers which have changed. And I think that's really important for people to remember. And maybe, I guess I'm talking more about historical documentation. And I think a lot of that gets lost very quickly as our times change. And, so much can be reflected on when we look at the places we used to shop at compared to now. And it's only a matter of time before bookstores might go away. I just think, I think of that in terms of history, the near past.
Well, I think you make a great point that there's kind of a layering that goes on in cities and communities that you like to be able to peel back the layers and see what was there 10 years ago. And we should be documenting that kind of thing. Because with historic preservation, it's not that we change things necessarily. It's we kind of layer on to places.
Well, what it's about like that, Jeff and Helen? I think you're getting at, you're on the edges of the internet age, mm-hmm. and how we don't have the same kinds of papers anymore. We don't think to print out the same kinds of things. And is that going to, do you think that's going to have any effect on historic preservation?
Well, I think in terms of documentation, it's only to our advantage. We have, you know, so many more images that we've collected. I don't know, you know, 100 years from now, whether all, what cloud they're going to be in, but we probably have more documentation now than we ever had of our environment. Mm-hmm. So we can capture points of time in places a lot better than we may have in the past.
Jeff, thank you so much for such an interesting comment.
Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. What about neon signs? There are modern ones we know by living artists, but there are ones from the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, and onward that are so magnificent. And they, you know, you can see them for sale in places now. I've seen them hanging around on old buildings and then disappearing. Is that something that qualifies in the world of historic preservation?
Well, I'm not really sure, because signs, I know they are attached to the earth, but are they really structures? I don't, you know, I mean, and so I guess I think that they're more of an artifact that would be a collectible by a museum or something. Although certainly in the landscape, I think of, you know, Las Vegas, Atlantic City, and Miami, mm-hmm. and all those places where neon is still very valued. Or what's the place in New Jersey? The
right. I was thinking of, you know, will Las Vegas become Venice? You know what I mean? It's kind of a strange. I don't mean the fake Venice in Las Vegas. And so, what about post offices?
Oh, well, post offices actually are a huge preservation issue right now because they're being deaccessioned. And there are legal issues around that at the moment. Stamford is there's a lawsuit against the post office in Stamford, mainly because the bidding process, the procurement process for the potential developer was considered not a public process. But, you know, one, like the post office in Greenwich, it's on the Greenwich Avenue, it was bought by Peter Malkin, but it's going to be Restoration Hardware.
I walked by that building and thought, this is fantastic, this building, and then heard that this was going to happen. And I thought, wow. And right now it's some kind of mindfulness thing mixed with something else, isn't it?
That's the Stamford
one.
That's the Stamford
one. Okay. Now, the building in Clinton, Connecticut, which is the old Unilever building, Ponds, we would know it as all the Ponds products, the Ponds cold cream.
Right.
This, you know, amazing logo and deco design on this concrete structure. I've driven by it 1,000 times. And you're just off of downtown Clinton, and I think somebody has got to do something with that building, and things are mm-hmm. happening.
Well, that's actually, we've given a grant to the town of Clinton to create a National Register district, of historic places district, that would include the Ponds building. And the reason for that would then, it means that the Ponds building would then be eligible for historic tax credits, which act as a great incentive for redevelopment. But it's also a way of Clinton saying we value this recent past. You know, downtown Clinton is very colonial looking or post, you know, revolutionary looking. This is a completely different thing, and they're saying we want to include this in our understanding of our historic character here.
Mm. Heidi, Faith Middleton with Helen Higgins, Executive Director of the Connecticut Trust for Historic Preservation. Go ahead, Heidi.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question, comment for the...
Yes, go ahead.
I am very interested in historic cemeteries, and I visit them and have done pictures. And I am on board of directors for a cemetery in Fairhaven, and I'd like to get it on the list of historic registers. And I've tried by doing the process, emailing, and I haven't gotten replies back. Now, I was wondering if there's a better way of this process of getting this done.
What's interesting, Heidi, before Helen has ideas for you, is that there are people like you who just see something and say, this is so important in our midst, and as a citizen or someone who uses or appreciates this, I want to do something about this. And so you've started to fill out this paperwork. Helen Higgins, what do you think?
Well, I don't know the cemetery, but it's certainly many cemeteries are on the National Register, and I absolutely suggest that you call our office, and we will dispatch someone to come and talk to you about this. And I agree with you, cemeteries are fantastic historic places. I mean, some of the cemeteries in Hartford tell the story of Connecticut in a way, or even of the United States. Well, and also the Grove Street Cemetery here, which is a National Historic Landmark in New Haven, is just an extraordinary place of peace and beauty.
Thank you so much, Heidi.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. There is a town where there was a lot of granite quarrying, and the town was redoing its sidewalks and put in the macadam, you know, the black tar, as a curb. And, you know, one homeowner said, "Do you see that that's pink granite on the curb in front of my historic home? I want to leave that there." You can't take that up. It goes with this time period. And in the end, the homeowner won, but it was quite a struggle to get the town to understand that it was maybe more important to do this, you know, if you're of this mind, to do this than to have a uniform black tar curb running along this stretch
right.
of road.
Right. Right. It's that's a tough thing. I mean, the road widenings and things like that are very tough in preservation because there's a lot of federal money that pours into towns or regions, and the towns want to spend it, and the next thing you know, your road is widened.
So, Helen Higgins, let me ask you about this, because this can get tricky. In the town, the village of Stony Creek, Connecticut, there is, you know, quite a spirited dialogue about among people in the village about setting up a kind of historic neighborhood where there would be an appointed committee of people. And if your house is of a certain size and you wanted to make changes, you would have to put it by the committee. And the committee would then make its recommendation to the larger town about your request. And this is all in the talking stages, but to see how the kind of spirited dialogue that has gone on about that, and the questions that raises about, well, who's on the committee?
Yeah.
What's the taste of the members of the committee? What if they all look great now, but, you know, only like a certain period of architecture, or they only like small houses or big houses, so they say you can't paint your house a weird color. You know, it is not so easy. And yet, you know, certain people in town loving this idea because they want to preserve the character of the place, whatever that means to them. It begins to be about taste and scale and things like that.
Well, I think it's more about scale. Taste, I hope it's not about. I mean, I think there are objective standards that you can apply to a village district, which is what you're talking about. I didn't know you were Stony Creek was thinking about a panel, but basically a village district is run by the Planning and Zoning Commission. They're the final authority over it, and there are very specific guidelines. Many many towns have guidelines for architectural design, and that's really what this is about. And they can be very objective. And scale, I think, is one of the key things, particularly in a place like Stony Creek, which is very compact. And so that, you know, if you're going to build big and take over a lot of the lot, you know, it really is out of scale and out of the character of the town. or the village.
And what about that? What is wrong with that? If New York City, for instance, is constantly changing and scale is constantly moving, you know, everybody's saying, no, don't go higher than two stories. It's always been like this. And then they put up giant buildings. Mm-hmm. People forget. It's in flux constantly. So what if a small place decides, yeah, sure, but we're going to use it. We're going to put bigger houses on these lots. And then it will be like that. That will be the new standard. I mean, I have my own personal views about this stuff, but whose taste here or whose sense of scale is meant to reign and why?
Well, that's a fabulous question. I hadn't really thought about it that way because I live it in a different way. But I do understand the New York model of change. And I think of what's going on around Grand Central right now. And, you know, the Bloomberg administration trying to get a zone change so that buildings, you know, it can be much denser and the buildings can be much higher, which means that some of those lovely little like the Yale Club kind of places are all threatened mm-hmm. because they don't fit this model. So you're like, oh, you know, boo-hoo, isn't this awful? But then as you just say, is this the new model? Is it? I mean, New York is completely organic. I mean, it just grows like.
Well, yeah, it's never the same. It never.
It's just future shock. Remember that?
Yeah. Well, I think to myself when I look at colonials of a certain period that your organization worked so hard to preserve. I look at them and I think, wait a minute, this was a brand new house. One point.
Yeah.
This was modern.
Yeah, it was a brand new big house. And I mean, in Guilford, there's a street called Fair Street, where if you go down it, the mm-hmm. houses don't match, but mm-hmm. somehow it works.
It really works. Yeah. See, that's an interesting point that you raise. Sometimes in a place, people say, without saying the words, well, we want it to be of a more Victorian character and preserve and protect that. Right. Then you get to a street like Fair Street in Guilford, just off the Guilford Green. And all the houses are from different periods. Condos have been put in a mill building.
Right.
It's a fabulous street. Every kind of architecture. And you think, well, but that's an example of how it worked.
And I think if I knew more about scale, I think if you looked at the scale on that street, you would see most of the buildings are in sync with each other. They may have different angles.
But very big on the lots.
Mm-hmm. And very big on
they're
the lots.
Small lot, yep. big properties,
yep.
big houses.
Mm-hmm.
Jill Faith Middleton with Helen Higgins, Executive Director of the Connecticut Trust for Historic Preservation. Go ahead, Jill.
Hi, it's Jill Smith from the Merritt Parkway Conservancy.
Oh, yeah. Hi, Jill.
Hey, Jill.
Hi, Helen. I just wanted to mention that the Merritt Parkway is on the Historic Register and that each of its 69 original bridges introduced modern architecture styles that were just used primarily for buildings at that time, back in the 30s.
And so what does that mean in this final minute of the show? If they start to deteriorate, must they be built to the standard they were, the design they were?
Yes. Yes. I mean, we're working very hard with the Department of Transportation to make sure that the repairs are being made and that bridges mm-hmm. won't be torn down and rebuilt.
Ah, so you're on the case. Okay.
And the Merritt Parkway Conservancy is one of the best organizations in Connecticut. Good for you, Jill.
Oh, well, thank you.
Thanks. You so much for calling the show.
Okay, thank
Good
you.
Good luck to you. Thank you, Helen Higgins, for being on the show. Congratulations on this new thing, Creative Places Where Arts and Letters Flourished in 20th Century Connecticut, a new trail and map being created as we speak, artists and writers working and living in Connecticut. For information, go to cttrust.org. Helen Higgins, Executive Director, is our guest. As always, this show is about the richness of life, and you can find the books, people, great recipes, value wines, and cocktails we feature right now at wnpr.org. Click on Programs. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.